Fielder now must await approval from the baseball commissioner's office because money is involved. The Sox are in Minnesota tonight to wrap up a four-game series with the Twins. The Chicago Cubs are trying to record their first four-game sweep of the Milwaukee Brewers at Miller Park in 5 years this afternoon. The Cubs have outscored the Brewers 20-7 in the first three games. The Brewers, meanwhile, have lost a season-high four straight and are in a virtual tie with St. Louis for second in the division. In the bottom of the fifth in that game, the Cubs were leading the Brewers 5-0. The St. Louis Cardinals will try for a four-game sweep when they face off against Atlanta again tonight. St. Louis has limited Atlanta to 8 runs in the series after it gave up 24 in New York last weekend. Joel Piniero will be on the mound for St. Louis tonight. Atlanta plans to go with Mike Hampton. The U.S. Olympic basketball team is 2-0 in exhibition play. LeBron James led the way with 20 points and 6 rebounds in the Americans' 114-82 win over Turkey, a team that did not qualify for this year's Olympics. And Kentucky Derby and Preakness winner Big Brown drew the number 4 post and was made the 1-2 favorite for Sunday's $1 million Haskell Invitational at Monmouth Park in New Jersey. That's sports.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by the 6th Annual Sugar Creek Symphony and Song, presenting Donizetti's The Elixir of Love, August 1st through the 3rd, in the renovated Art Deco Watsika Theater in Watsika, Illinois, an opera about love, money, and a magic potion. More information at sugarcreekfestival.org.
It's 2:42. United Airlines says its pilots are abusing sick leave and causing hundreds of flight cancellations. The carrier has asked a federal court to step in and stop what it's calling unlawful job actions. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
United filed its lawsuit against the Airline Pilots Association and four pilots in particular, accusing them of orchestrating a slowdown by getting pilots to call in sick and discouraging others from flying additional hours. United calls the alleged action a deliberate and unacceptable protest of its plan to shrink the airline's fleet by 100 planes and cut 950 pilots' jobs to deal with soaring fuel prices. Spokesperson Jean Medina says the pilots' actions have hurt the airline and its customers.
We canceled 329 flights in less than 10 days. That was between July 19th and July 27th, inconveniencing some 36,000 customers. And based on our analysis, the probability of this being random is zero.
United also says the rate of co-pilot sick leave has more than doubled this summer. Union officials say their attorney still must review the lawsuit, but they call United's characterizations inaccurate and misleading. Airline analyst Richard Abulafala with the Teal Group calls the lawsuit a surprising escalation of a familiar fight.
The only way for U.S. airlines to get pricing power back, given high fuel prices, is to cut capacity. And that, of course, jeopardizes pilot stubs.
Pay stubs, that is. United officials say the lawsuit against the union was a last resort after efforts to mitigate the plan cuts failed. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
A 300-year-old art form is making an appearance in Chicago. Hundreds of people are in the Windy City from around the world to take tap classes as part of the Chicago Human Rhythm Project summer festival called Rhythm World. It's billed as the oldest and largest tap dance festival in North America. Some of the participants spent a recent evening trying to outdo one another in front of a live audience. Lynette Kalsness has this report.
Danny Aiken is a summer intern with the Rhythm Project, but he's also a contestant in a tap improv show that's just about to start. So he's practicing his steps while going over last-minute details on a clipboard.
Describe what footwear you're tapping in.
I'm tapping in a pair of flip-flops.
Of course, he'll change into tap shoes for the cutting contest. It starts with 17 people. They face off two at a time. The first contestant taps out a measure of music and the other dancer responds. They go back and forth, showing off their footwork and stealing each other's moves. It's the tap equivalent of take that or top this. That was the William Tell Overture.
Your phrasing is just completely musical. I mean, you can sing a melody with your tap. you can say a sentence with your tap. I mean, if you're listening, you can hear it all. It's in there.
Noted performer and choreographer Jason Samuel Smith says tap is a great form to have a battle in. Tonight, he's a judge.
It's about, you know, people just stretching themselves, seeing how far they can take the art form and seeing how good they can be in that moment. And, you know, you live to dance another day if you lose.
Samuel Smith is looking for creativity and a crisp sound. Contests like this have been going on nearly as long as tap itself.
The history of tap really is almost as old as the United States.
That's Lane Alexander, who founded the Chicago Human Rhythm Project. He says tap dates back to the days of slavery. So many people died in the holds of ships, sea captains started bringing slaves up for fresh air and exercise. They do African dances on deck. Irish sailors who'd been pressed into service would respond with their own dances.
And it may have been a moment like that when African and Irish culture first saw each other. And that was the beginning of the process that's gone on for the last 300 years, really, of creating a new American art form of tap dance.
That old art form is appealing to a new generation. All the contestants at the cutting contest are men and women in their teens and 20s, like Matthew Shields from Texas.
There's like a challenge there to one-up the other dancers. You have to be quick on your toes, and it's a learning experience. You know, you grow after you do something like this.
He started tapping as a kid when he got dragged to his sister's dance classes. The leaders put all the boys in a room with some tap shoes and promised them pizza. Shields was hooked.
I really liked the communication through your mind into the floor. I mean, there's a whole body connection there. It has to go from all the way to the top, all the way to the bottom, and then out.
He dances his way back to the auditorium with minutes to go. He doesn't know it yet, but Tristan Bruins from the South Loop will be his first opponent.
Right now, like, my head feels like it's full of helium, and my heart's thumping in my chest, and my stomach's a little queasy, and I'm really afraid, but it's so much fun. I mean, this is what people write books about, like this feeling. This is the feeling people write songs about, to get up in front of people and just kind of come up with whatever's in your head. You know, you can really express yourself.
Minutes later, Bruins comes up against Shields. Jason Samuel Smith gives them a waltz tempo.
One, two, three,
they both struggle. Samuel Smith starts them over again. Shields is the first dancer who crosses the stage and gets into his opponent's space. He wins this round, but eventually gets beaten by a young Brazilian.
May the best dancer win. Here we go. One, two, three,
in the end, it's the young woman from Tokyo with excellent timing and rhythm, who's not quite so flashy, who wins. Ryona Otsuka gets $100 and breaking rights. I'm Lynette Kalsnes, Chicago Public Radio.
The annual Rhythm World Festival concludes this weekend with a series of performances in Chicago. For more information, go to chicagotap.org. Next up, Hidden Kitchens feature from the Kitchen Sisters. Today on Hidden Kitchens, the worlds of a young Canadian immigrant, an Italian family of pasta makers, and an Armenian grandmother converge in the story of the creation of the San Francisco treat. The Kitchen Sisters, producers Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, present The Birth of Rice-A-Roni.
Rice-A-Roni, the San Francisco treat. I'm Lois DiDomenico. I grew up in Edmonton, Canada. I met my husband, Tommy, in 1944 in San Francisco. His father and his brothers and he had a pasta factory. When the war was over, there was no place to live. All these hundreds of thousands of soldiers were coming home. So I saw this ad that said, lady who lived alone would like to rent out one room of her apartment. Mrs. Captanian. I had a liking for her right away. So we moved in. Tommy would work until, what, 7 o'clock every night at Golden Grain Pasta Company. I was alone a lot. I was only 18, and I was pregnant, and I had kitchen privileges. Well, I really wasn't much of a cook. And here was this Armenian lady, probably about 70 at the time, making yogurt on the back of the stove all day, every day. I didn't even know what the word yogurt meant.
My grandmother's name was Pailadzu Kaptanian. Grandma Kap is what we called her. My name is Ted Kaptanian. She babysat us when we were 4 or 5 years old. She would always be wanting to cook us stuffed grape leaves, baklava, and rice pilaf.
Pilaf, Armenian way. She taught me how to make that. We would bring her Golden Grain vermicelli. She wanted us to break it as small as rice if we could. The kitchen was teeny tiny, like a closet. But right around the corner was a huge big round table. And when she rolled out her dough for baklava, she would roll and roll until every bit of that dining room table was covered with this sheet of phyllo dough. She would hold it up and she would say, "See, Lois, you have to be able to see through the dough." I can remember sitting there and Mrs. Kaptanian telling me her life story. She was in Armenia, 1915, 16, when the massacre happened, which, by the way, the Turkish people still don't agree that it ever happened. She was pregnant with one child and had two other boys.
This is a copy of her book, her memoirs of that exodus from Armenia. She wanted to guarantee that somebody knew what happened.
My name is Meline Pelivanyan, working in the Berlin State Library as the Armenia and Turkey specialist. About 15 years ago, I found by chance this little book from Pailadzu Kaptanian. It is a rare book. There are not so much first-hand memoirs of this time. It was 1915, the deportation of the Armenian population of Turkey began. Pailadzu Kaptanian left her two little sons with a Greek family. She knew that it would be death for all the Armenians. About 2 weeks later, the husband of Pailadzu is killed.
Where are my two children whom I abandoned? My heart is breaking with longing to see them again. Alone at night, I repeat cradle songs for their sake. And while I tell
Mrs. Kaptanian wrapped her feet in rags and walked through the Middle East.
There were only women, little children, and old men. They walked about 12 hours a day through mountains, and there were no food or little food.
Eventually, my grandmother made it to Syria, where she gave birth to my father after having walked for months to escape.
I used to sit in Mrs. Kaptanian's kitchen and listen to this amazing story of this woman. When I left her apartment, we got our own flat, and I made her Armenian pilaf a lot. One night, my husband and his brother Vincent were eating pilaf in my kitchen. Vincent looked at it, and he took it apart, and he said, "You know, this would be great in a box."
We had a kitchen down in the plant. He would cook the dish up, and we would taste it. I would bring home some samples and ask my wife how she liked it. Shake it, baby, shake it, cause I love it. We needed a name for the product. We were saying, well, what is the product? Rice and macaroni. Why don't we call it rice-a-roni? The name had a ring to it.
Rice-a-roni, the San Francisco treat.
Rice-a-roni, the delicious break from potatoes.
There were not very many packaged side dishes in the market in 1955. I'm Dennis DiDomenico, son of Lois and Tom DiDomenico. Everything was being geared towards less time in the kitchen, dishwashers and garbage disposals. The convenience factor was everything.
When I was young, we'd see these commercials for Rice-a-roni. Every time we hear that jingle, my father would say, "You know, your grandmother gave a rice recipe to the people who started that company." So every time you hear it, you can think of your grandmother. To be honest, we kind of thought, could that possibly be true, that this iconic American dish Could that actually be attributed to some recipe my Armenian grandmother gave someone years ago?
I still make pilaf the way Mrs. Kaptanian taught me. The impact she had on me and my life, I only lived there 4 months, but it was 4 months that brought all these things together. Myself from Canada, Tommy, Italian, Mrs. Kaptanian, Armenian, all that converging in San Francisco in 1946. And out of that comes Rice-A-Roni.
The Kitchen Sisters produced that piece. The Kitchen Sisters are Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. For more on the San Francisco treat, visit npr.org.
Earth and Sky.
Thursday, July 31st, 2008. If you're at the right place on Earth tomorrow, you can watch one of nature's grandest spectacles, a total eclipse of the sun.
During a total solar eclipse, the new moon completely covers the sun's disk. The moon's shadow sweeps over Earth, and for those in the shadow's path, day turns momentarily into night. The sun's normally invisible outer atmosphere, the corona, appears in a glowing circle around the dark moon's silhouette.
Because the tip of the moon's dark shadow barely reaches Earth, a total eclipse only lasts a few minutes at any one location. The width of the moon's shadow varies somewhat, but it's only around 240 kilometers or 150 miles wide. The moon's dark umbral shadow will first touch the Earth at sunrise in northern Canada tomorrow. The narrow eclipse path will cross the Arctic, Russia, Mongolia, and China.
The total solar eclipse path will end at sunset in eastern China tomorrow, and then the moon's dark shadow will lift off the Earth's surface and fall into the vastness of space. Although only a tiny fraction of the Earth's surface gets to see the total solar eclipse, most of Europe and Asia are in a position to witness a partial solar eclipse on August 1st. We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programming is made possible in part by the U of I College of Law. Established in 1897, the U of I College of Law is committed to the highest standards of academic excellence. More information and a schedule of upcoming public lectures are available at www.law.uiuc.edu.
Sunday afternoon at 5, join us for a live broadcast of Keeping the Faith. Each week, host Steve Shoemaker and his guests explore issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. This week's topic is the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and Steve's guest is the Fellowship's director, Dr. Mark Johnson. That's Keeping the Faith, Sunday afternoon at 5. A severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for Ford, Iroquois, and Livingston counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area until 7 o'clock tonight.